They did have pulmonary edema, from my observations at least, and according to the physicians who were attending them.
Mike, you saw a gas use, didn't you? Did they use gas?
No.
Somebody in here said they're using
it. Something I can go along with. It's a chemical. I don't even know exactly what chemical was used. I just saw what had happened to children in this Dung Ha Children's Hospital from various use of chemicals and a lot of the other things people have been seeing the last few days. Gas possibly could have been the cause of these things. I'm not really sure, but it was transacted from childbirth, and there was a whole ward. It was about 12 kids, little kids who'd been born deformed through causes of gas, chemicals, whatever agents were used, you know, in the country by the United States. But these kids were deformed. One kid's feet was turned around, and he was walking on the joints of his ankles. His elbows were also inverted. His hands were backwards. There's people born with various deformities that you could go on, you know, an excessive amount.
My guess is you're talking about defoliating agents. There are three versions.
Couldn't exactly say what chemical or what defoliants caused it, but it was.
Was there a scenario where they were defoliating? Or you don't know?
They defoliate just about the whole, you know, portions all over the whole country, so you can't designate a specific area.
Well,
at least in this place, I couldn't.
I'm sure many of you were here, but Agent Orange, which is sometimes called 245T, is known to be teratogenic or cause birth defects in a number of experimental animals. We have dropped, supposedly not, it's outlawed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it has supposedly been, we have stopped using it in Vietnam. However, the Vietnamese are reportedly still using it. We have dropped 40 million pounds of this agent on Vietnam.
I think my understanding is the way a mother would come in contact with this. These Vietnamese people get most of their drinking water is rainwater. They keep barrels. They have a barrel outside of their house, and they have like a catch basin on top of the house, and the water runs down into the barrel. Well, these women, everyone drinks out of this water. And a woman can contract, if she drinks about a quart of this water, will cause damage to a child while she's in pregnancy.
That's right. We saw some pictures of that yesterday. Why don't we, because of the time. The last thing, Dave, why don't you tell us about some of your experiences of our policy about drug addiction within U.S. military personnel. U.S. military personnel have problems with drug addiction or drug abuse.
Well, this is a subject that, you know, we started on and we went into somewhat extensively on Sunday when we were talking about what we do to ourselves. And I think it's just worth repeating the fact that if you went there, as I went there, a fully trained psychiatrist, and that makes me have enough brains in my head, supposedly, to come up with a standing diagnosis for any one individual. And our policy and the regulations which I worked under precluded my being able to send people out of country for further treatment that I could make a positive diagnosis of severe physical addiction to a drug such as heroin or opium. In this country, we consider this a big enough disorder that we hospitalize people for this and we take them away from the source of the drug. There was no way to take people away from the source of the drug in Vietnam, and that doesn't come as any new bit of information to anybody, any of the vets that were here. You get drugs anywhere. There's no problem where that was concerned. I dislike to use the word, but I can't really think of another one. I was monitored where this was concerned. It took 2 days for my Medivac write-ups for the Medivac-E to get on the plane and get the hell out of country. He went to Tansanute the next day, and he rested there for a day, and then he got on the plane and went the following day. So this left plenty of time for my write-ups to go up Long Bend to the office of the psychiatric consultant from the Surgeon General's office for Vietnam. And if I try to push something through like this, I would get a phone call and I would be told that this was simply not, am I coming through? This was simply not policy, and that I could not, what the hell was I doing trying to medevac this person out of country? The one person that stands out largest in my memory was a black kid who came in on six different occasions, had shot up to 30 cc's of heroin or opium a day, 4 cc's at a crack 7-8 times a day. If this is not addiction, I don't know what it is. And he would be taken by the MPs back to some MP unit and then be released to his company commander again, because there's such a rampant problem, they didn't have space for these people, and so they didn't know what the hell to do with them, so they ended up giving them back to the company commander. And the company commander may or may not have been an understanding guy. He'd try to put the man back to work, and of course this man would be back in the hospital again. I harbored a few of these people for a while. Most of my patients were on Ward 8, and I would sneak these people up to Ward 9, which was a convalescent ward. And again, I constantly got bombarded from the hospital itself, because regulations there said I couldn't keep anybody for more than 30 days. And I got called down front many times and accused of harboring individuals, and I confessed to it. But these were the people who had been in so many times that, you know, it was like clockwork, 3 days or 4 days from the time I let them out, they'd be back. And I kept trying to tell people this, and I kept getting turned off. Nobody ever offered me an explanation as to what I should have done with these folks, except wean them off the drug at that particular time and don't worry about their addiction. And their ETS, or their DROS day, their day for leaving, would rotate around sometime, and I'd be rid of that problem, and I'd just have another one to handle. And this is about the way it went for me all year long.
Didn't have any methadone?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that on Sunday. Again, it's worth mentioning again, I suppose. I was denied methadone. I don't know why the hell I was denied methadone, but I broke people on Thorazine. And I might say, you know, it served the purpose, and most people adequately came down. But that doesn't take away the addiction, and it's not the drug of choice. Anybody who has any medical school training knows that. That's a simple proposition, and I think that one of the things that was put forth was that it was too expensive, and, you know, that's a crock of shit. It's a cent and a half a tablet.
In terms of hard drug use, that's heavy use of barbiturates, heroin, speed, how many of these guys started over there? Any idea?
Well, I don't have figures, because I never kept figures. It would have made a tremendous study, I suppose, for somebody's article. But I felt so sick inside most of the time, I wasn't really concerned with articles. I'd say that probably one out of two, or two out of five, or three out of five of the people who would come in would outrightly confess to me that they had taken nothing. Maybe they'd smoked some pot while they were in this country, but that was about the extent of it. And I don't know what their purpose would have been in lying. I really don't know.
Yeah, just about any kind of drug that you can think of, from heroin on down, if you couldn't get it from one of the guys in the hospital, it could be bought downtown. And
it was no problem to get drugs up onto the ward, even. While I'm at it, there's another thing I'd like to get my licks in on, and I'd forgotten about it until right now. When I came into country, I was shown my office. The office was in the back of an area which had been the day room, and that would have been okay. The day room had some things we could have used almost for therapy. At that time, it had pool tables and ping pong tables, this kind of thing, card tables. This place had been turned into a special services library and had been carpeted much the same as the carpeting on this floor. And rows and rows of books had been put up, and most of the time, the damn thing just went to no avail. It was a good showpiece for people who came in to see Third Field and Nurses in Whites, et cetera, et cetera. But the psychiatric office And I made this clear to people that I was talking to Sunday night. That office and I had a real fancy name, Chief of Department of Psychiatry and Neurology. That was fine, except there was no other psychiatrist and there was no neurologist. So I was it, and I had a social worker and two techs, and then I had to fight like hell when they went home to get some more techs to replace them. The type of degradation that I felt that this particular service of medicine was held in, here I sat with my office in the back of a special services library. This wasn't bad enough. We continued under this. But my inpatient service was on an open medical ward, and I'd just like to describe the ward briefly to you. This was a huge ward that was subdivided much the same way as these pillars subdivide. And on that side and back away from the nursing station, and on that side and back away from the nursing station, were medical patients. The variety had pneumonia, this kind of thing. Down the sides from the nursing station, because it seemed like the best thing to do, the psychiatric patients were housed. And this would include, anyone from a psychopath to a neurotic to a psychotic. And the kicker to all this is that in the middle was the intensive care unit for cardiac patients who were on monitors. And what I'm telling you is the truth. I think could be confirmed. Off to the left, by the way, was the renal unit, which was the only renal unit in Vietnam. And briefly, if you're in the renal unit, you're in there because you just can't make pee. And that's because you've got so many other injuries that your kidneys shut down, so they put you on a machine that drains all your blood out and filters it and cleans it out for you and then puts it back in. And I had a paranoid patient walking around in there. One night, I was told, after I left the ward, talking about people were drawing knives on him, et cetera, et cetera. And, if you're in a state of paranoia and you're walking around seeing people that are having all their blood taken out of them, and you go for a further walk and you see people on cardiac monitors, it's pretty bad.
The last subject, because of our time again, this is not a war crime. It probably should be. It would happen in a war of 10 years. Okay, anybody? VD, what have we done to the Vietnamese people with venereal disease? Joe, you want to hit them with it, or you got that?
It's a strange subject to talk about.
Huh?
It's a strange subject to talk about, but my contribution would be the observations about our brigade's activities in the Dak Tho area when we used military personnel, military equipment, and military time to construct a large wooden framed restaurant, which was staffed by Vietnamese girls. I believe there were at any time from 12 to 14 who provided services for an entire brigade of about 4,500 men on a volunteer basis, alphabetically. The charge was approximately $2.50, and it also required a great deal of time and materiel and manpower from the medical company to examine these women several times a week. So it was more or less a command policy that prostitution be part of the military operation.
I can add to that that in the travels I had through the South, each and every one of the battalion areas of the 3rd Brigade of the 9th Infantry Division, located 40 miles south of Saigon, each had their own, under the Army sign for the PX, the post exchange, buildings that were erected for the purpose, supposedly, of a steam bath and massage. And each one of these things was, I talked to these medics. Some of these medics had a full-time chore to sit down there. That was his day's work, and to examine the GIs who wanted to partake of this particular service. I'm not so much against the service myself as I am the fact that these were Vietnamese people and they were being used in this fashion. If you want to be a prostitute, I guess that's your own business, but I'm not so sure that that was the case. I just don't know. I know that the treatment for it, we were developing strains of gonococcal organisms that were so virulent that we're having a very, very difficult time eradicating them from people. Over here, I'm not too sure now what the normal dosage for, we didn't see much syphilis, that's not worth talking about, but I don't know what the treatment for an average strain of gonorrhea or gonococcus would be. I suspect it's in the realm of a million and two-tenths of penicillin. But the standing order over there was a combination of 4.8 million units of penicillin IM and something like 16 tablets of 250 milligram tetracycline per day for 3 or 4 days running, and then a continued dosage after that. And a lot of the times that this really didn't do the trick either. There were still people who were still having difficulty. And I think the long-range thing, when we're talking about what we do to Vietnam, with this thing coming up, when we leave, it stays.
And how about the treatment of the Vietnamese? Then, you know, can he get all these drugs to kill that organism?
No, it's not readily available to them. I you know, further earlier in this panel, I indicated to you that, you know, I stole the penicillin to treat a pneumonia.
At Da Nang, it was the same situation existed everywhere outside of a military installation. You had houses of prostitution.
WBAI New York.
Built by the military, or at least maintained by the 95th Evacuation Army Hospital at Da Nang. On the road leading to it were four houses, and the women who were the prostitutes who worked there received their treatment from sympathetic doctors and corpsmen that worked at the hospital, the evacuation hospital there. The Air Force, we had a very large number of Air Force personnel at our base, and we had a immunization clinic for the GIs, and the longest lines for any of the immunizations were the penicillin lines for VD. And if one of the Vietnamese women came in, whether she worked on the base or wherever she worked, claiming that she had gotten VD, gonorrhea, or whatever, from a GI, she was always refused treatment on the grounds that if you treated one, you'd have to treat them all.
Are there any last comments? We have just 1 minute each. And
I have one that I'd like to make. That this isn't really a war crime, but Jeff can back me up on this because he was there and he saw the same thing. From the 95th Evacuation Hospital and from other hospitals in the area, when we received patients, they all funneled their patients into the 22nd Casualty Staging Flight where I worked to be medevaced either to another base in Vietnam, which is usually Cam Ranh Bay, or out of country to Japan or the Philippines or to the States. We would receive Korean and American and Australian and whatever other casualties besides Vietnamese were taken. Occasionally we get through, I mean, I shouldn't say occasionally, it was a regular thing, men who had been wounded and had not had their dressings changed in days. We would receive patients through who had amputations of the legs or arms. And when we tried to change the dressings on these patients, we'd find that they were hard. I mean, it was an ace wrap elastic bandage like you use in athletics. They were solid, and the only thing that had been done for them was to pour betadine, which is an antiseptic, over these wounds. After you soaked them and got them down, there were maggots inside. And these were our own men. And this is the medical treatment they received. And this isn't a thing that happened just once. It happened all the time. And
this was one hospital, is that right? Mainly.
Yeah, this was specifically from the 95th Evacuation Hospital. And those kind of things go on over there all the time. And
we had this one GI who came in who had this big gaping wound on the lower part of his leg. The dressings hadn't been changed in about 3 weeks. It was the same dressing. I think it was the original battle dressing you had on there. Now, why, I don't know. But that's, it happens.
This is the superior medical care that we have.
I was a recipient of some information today that made me think back, and I went home to get this because I think that this man who, for all good reasons, remains nameless, was shipped to us from the 91st Evacuation Hospital in Chulai. I think that this man, as the story was given to us, this man was a recipient of some of our own misdirected fire. Whether he was or whether he wasn't, I don't believe really serves any purpose. But this man had so many diagnoses, and this is a photocopy or a transcript of the admission note when he came in. He had so many diagnoses that they ran out of space on this paper, and they put the rest on a second one. And I sort of keep it as a mute testimony of what not only these kind of weapons can do, but what can happen, and what I was part of. I've many times thought about throwing it away, but I never do, and I really don't know the reason for that. I suspect I do somewhere. But this man had a penetrating wound of all his extremities, face, chest, abdomen, genitals. He had a perforation of the small bowel, a contusion of the transverse colon, a laceration of the liver, a transection of his distal ureter on the right, a ruptured bladder, a wound open penetrating of the rectum, fracture of the pelvis, rupture of the right spermatic cord, rupture of his penis, fracture of some of the bones in his leg, contusions of his lower left lung lobe, a hemothorax, which is blood in the thorax, acute renal failure, and peritonitis. And the thing about it is that really struck home with me was he was admitted to our hospital on 22 June 1970. He was to go home 16 July 1970.
Thank you. We some of us have to make a plan, so we're going to have to go. I would like to just share with you one last comment during my 3 days here. I think all of us have been extremely frustrated by the lack of national press coverage. We came from many parts of the country, often at our own expense. And this isn't the only country where there's a blackout on news. We're not sure why. We feel what we had to say here was significant, and we all can prove we were in Vietnam. This is a Saigon newspaper, which I've saved. And this is an English language newspaper. It's quite obvious that they did not want us to get certain kinds of information. And in terms of the hearing that you've heard in the past 3 days, it's obvious that somebody does not want the American people to hear what we had to say here. Thank you.
Thank you.
He correlates this information with previous intelligence data, with information from the SLAR radar and the IR night vision device to determine the mission of the grouping Earthmen. The mission, the IBM 360 decides, is dangerous. Another bolt of electricity carries the word to the TACFIRE central computer. This computer determines the appropriate tactical response and flashes this information to one of the interlinked data processing systems in the field. One aircraft releases a laser-guided bomb, automatically released by the computer at the appropriate time. Another releases an EO, or Walleye television-guided bomb, with its nose cone, with a television camera in its nose cone, focused clearly on the six Earthmen. This Walleye 2 bomb follows this picture on a self-contained TV screen, correcting its course with a wave of its movable fins until it reaches the target. The highly lethal firepower eliminates this threat to the invading masters and successfully sanitizes the area. Meanwhile, in Zone F, another blip appears on a screen. Does this sound as if it were set in the year 2000 by a science fiction writer? It's actually set for the 1970s by the U.S. Pentagon. In fact, at this very moment, in a war room at Fort Hood, Texas, the Master Group, which stands for Mobile Army Sensor Systems Test Evaluation and Review, is evaluating reports on TACFIRE, Tactical Fire Direction System, and the Integrated Battlefield Control System. In July of 1969, the U.S. Army set up a program called Surveillance, Target Acquisition, and Night Observation to plan, test, and put into operation a totally controlled and computerized electronic battlefield. William Westmoreland, who commanded the U.S. forces in Vietnam and is now Army Chief of Staff, discussed the automated battlefield in a speech to the Association of the U.S. Army last year. On the battlefield of the future, Westmoreland said, enemy forces will be located, tracked, and targeted almost instantaneously through the use of data links, computer-assisted intelligence evaluation, and automatic fire control. These weapons have been actually have, well, the computer systems for detection have been used both in Cambodia and in Vietnam and in Laos, largely so far on a experimental basis. They've been testing detection systems which amplify the light of the stars and numerous other detection systems which are integrated into the ADSAF, Automatic Data System for the Army in the Field. Some of these sensors were released in some of the information on these sensors was released by the Senate Armed Services Committee in hearings released last week, and they do show pictures of some of these sensory devices, but they're probably too small for many of you to see. But in this case, the AccuBoy is a sensor. It's camouflaged, dropped in the jungle, and it catches in the trees. And there it's camouflaged, just looks like part of the jungle, but it actually picks up voices. And during the hearings in Washington, they played tapes in which you could hear the Vietnamese talking as they walked by, hear what they were saying. Very, very clear detection of everything that was being said in the jungle below. And this ADSID is a seismic detector that falls down into the ground and gets buried in the ground with just the antenna sticking up. And it too, then can continue to transmit data through the data links and so forth to the computers, or to they're moving more and more toward the computers, but starting with a lot of man-controlled elements in this. During these hearings, they mentioned specific use of this in the Iglo White program in Laos. It's a specific operation called Commando Bolt. An assessment officer monitors the sensor activations in the area of interest. When he recognizes a target signature from a particular sensor string, he calls up on his cathode ray tube a sketch of the road net which that string of sensors is monitoring. The computer automatically displays and updates on the CRT the movement of the target along the road,